Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted.
May I proceed? May it please the court. My name is Donald Brookheiser, and I'm representing the petitioners in this matter. I've asked, with the court's permission, to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The main issue in this case is what method should be used to allocate transmission costs to the various customer classes of PG&E. And as we've distilled the issue in our briefing, I think it really comes down to for which of the competing methodologies is there substantial evidence in the record to support the use of the methodology, and whether the methodology produces a just and reasonable result. We've advocated the use of a coincident peak method as accurately capturing the cost causation by the standby class. This is the class of customers that receives power from PG&E whenever their generator fails and they have to rely on the system for power. And there are several major pieces of evidence in the record that support the use of the coincident peak method as opposed to the methodology proposed by PG&E. First of all,
but isn't the question is system planning done solely are your costs based solely on the incremental cost of expanding capacity, or is there anything in the record that shows that?
Your Honor, our position is that it's not a question of what is the incremental expansion and how those costs should be allocated. Rather, we're talking about the revenue requirement for the entire transmission system. That system didn't spring into existence at one moment. It's been constructed over time. And that transmission planning process that was described in the record has been used repeatedly to decide how the transmission system should be built and expanded. So the transmission system that we have today, or that was for whose costs this case was brought, that is the result of repeated assessments and transmission planning. So we're not simply talking about the process of one isolated annual assessment of the transmission system and what additions might be made to the system because of that and what should be done with those incremental costs. Rather, we're talking about how did PG&E construct its system over time and how should the total revenue requirement of the system be allocated among classes. And I think the evidence is clear that the system is built to meet the annual system peak of the utility. That's the standard used throughout the process. And that the standby class's contribution to the system peak is used in that process.
I thought the FERC's argument was that that's certainly one component of system planning, but there are other costs, the overall operation and maintenance, so that you don't need to simply look at what I think you're suggesting, and what I tried to say before, that the incremental costs that come from accommodating peak, right?
That's correct. Well, I may be confusing a couple of things. I don't think FERC is arguing or has admitted that contribution to system peak is one element. The Commission's decision in this case says, rather than looking at system peak, you look at the costs that the utility incurs to stand by, ready to serve.
Readiness.
And our argument is those costs are measured by contribution to system peak. The standby class, let me start again. PG&E has an obligation to meet the standby class's demand.
If there's something in the record that shows, other than that, do you lose? Is your case turn on that?
I'm sorry.
That system planning is driven primarily by accommodating peak.
That's correct. That our case depends on that basic principle.
Okay.
And I'm not aware of anything in the record that indicates that system planning is done on any other basis.
Where does this probabilist or the probability methodology or whatever, but where do the probabilities come from?
What PG&E's position is that if you're looking at system peak, there's a possibility that because the standby class's use is random, it's based on unplanned outages of their generator, that some usage that might occur sometime else at some other point in the summer months, which is their peak period, their position is that that use sometime during those summer months might just as likely occur in the system peak hour. And so they've made a calculation of the.
But how do they make the calculation? Is that solely on the basis of historical trends in the past? Or?
Yes, it is. And there's quite a bit of detail in the record. I can cite you to the pages if you'd like. But basically, they took groups of customers and calculated the likelihood of that group of customers putting a demand on the system at any time during the summer peak period, which is between May and October, weekdays between 9:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m.
And this was just on the basis of the trends in the past, or what happened in the past?
It's based on historical data.
Did I recall reading some testimony indicated it was also on the basis of discussions between PG&E and the representatives of the standby customers?
Well, that's the testimony of Mr. Morris, and he did testify that when they're doing this annual assessment and constructing their load forecast, they look at historical data for how much the standby customers are using in load, and then they also look at how much the standby customers' generators were providing, so that they want to calculate just the net amount that the customer is drawing from the grid.
Right.
Because his generator is going to be providing some or all of his load. And so Mr. Morris testified that they look at historical data. They may also talk to, the customer, and there may be some adjustments for how the customer may intend to use their generator.
So tell me what the problem with that methodology is.
Well, it doesn't reflect how PG&E actually incurs costs. The suggestion is by PG&E that because this use is random and unpredictable, the PG&E has to stand by ready to serve a larger load than evidenced by the coincident peak.
Right.
But that's not there's no evidence that in fact is correct. This 12CP method, just to put some numbers on this, would assign the standby class 25 megawatt months of demand to the class. PG&E's method would assign approximately 100 megawatt months. And so when they're doing planning, what they incorporate into the plan, when they're doing their assessment of adequacy, is the 25 or a number equivalent to, to the 25 megawatt month amount.
Are you just saying that because PG&E builds excess capacity that they don't have to worry about the standby because they can take care of that with their excess capacity anyway?
Well, in part, I think. But that's true of their service for all classes.
Yeah.
That's the result of planning for the system peak. If you build your system to meet the 1 hour during the entire year when your demand is at its maximum, then at all other hours in the year,
you can
accommodate some flexibility. In Exhibit 51 that's in the record, shows the contribution.
Just to follow up on that, that doesn't mean you get a free ride. It just means that your argument is we should be that our rate should be the same as everybody else's.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That the system is
constructed. Because there's no extra cost to PG&E just because we're standby and the others are not.
That's correct.
Okay, got it. Okay.
So let me see, make sure I've got it. So you're saying there's no need to charge a premium for lack of predictability?
That's correct, because the lack of predictability
is already factored in.
Is not a cost driver.
Mm-hmm. It should not be a cost driver, or it is not a cost driver?
Well, it is not a cost driver, so there's no evidence in the record that supports its use. But I guess it could be a cost driver if, in fact, the utility used that to do its planning. And that's, you see that in some of the other cases that we cited, Central Power and Light and Florida Power and Light, where the commission's decision was based on how the utility actually used the contract demand or the potential demand from the customer in its planning. If that were the case, if PG&E actually said, because of the unpredictability, we need to be standing by ready with 100 megawatts of capacity rather than 25 megawatts, then that may be a basis for a different allocation to my customer class. But that's not the case. There's no evidence that they use anything other than the contributions to system peak.
Other than, I didn't catch your last word. What was it? Contributions other than
the contribution to system peak. In other words, the contribution of the standby class at the system peak hour is used in planning, just in that assessment, just like the contribution of every other customer class. That concludes my remarks. At this point, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. Jeff Dennis for the commission. I wanted to start with really the fundamental point of this case. The standby customers that are at issue here and the rate that they will be charged by PG&E, these folks are fundamentally random. Their use of the system is fundamentally random, and the presiding administrative law judge found that in her decision, and the commission affirmed that decision. It is that randomness that really is the key to why PG&E had to make an adjustment to the 12CP methodology to account for these customers' use of the system. You were correct, Judge Griffith, in that the petitioners, our only argument here is that because PG&E plans a system to meet system peak, that therefore that is the only driver. They've said repeatedly in this case that PG&E only incurs costs when it puts steel into the ground. And the commission found here that simply isn't the case, that PG&E incurs a cost in the nature of revenue requirements to operate its entire system. And the judge found below, based on record evidence, particularly the testimony of PG&E's witness, Mr. Bell, that in fact PG&E incurs a cost to stand ready to serve these customers.
What cost does it incur to stand ready?
Mr. Bell characterized it as a capacity requirement as a capacity requirement. The PG&E has to stand ready at all times to be prepared to serve this load.
Well, we know that. That's what the contract requires. But what are the costs that it incurs by standing ready? What are they attributable to?
Well, what we're looking at here, Your Honor, is what share of the total system revenue requirements, the total system cost, should be shared in by these customers. And what Mr. Bell says in his testimony, and I will point you to the record at JA 17 and carrying over to 18, he makes the point that PG&E is obligated to provide all of this service at any time it's demanded, including at system peak. And therefore, there's a, he says it on the top of 194 in the transcript, and it's page 18 in the joint appendix, there's a capacity requirement and cost responsibility that should be attached to the right to take this service. We're looking at what benefits do these customers get from the system and what costs do they incur, and that's...
There should be some cost responsibility attached to the right to take that level of demand when needed, but only when needed.
Correct.
Yeah, I know, but what is the cost to PG&E for standing by? There should be some cost responsibility. He's talking about the standby customers having a cost responsibility, but that's not my question. My question is, what is the cost that PG&E incurs?
Well, I don't think PG&E, I can't point you to a specific dollar amount, you know, $50, $100 million.
But that's the point. Isn't that the petitioner's point, though, that there's nothing in the record that shows that PG&E incurs any costs that are specific to standing by?
Well, I think the problem with that argument is that the judge found otherwise based on Mr. Bell's testimony. And I would also point out, I mean, this is a – what we're looking at here, again, I think the myopic focus on planning has led us a little bit astray. There is a total system revenue requirement. PG&E incurs a cost every year to maintain this system, and it's reflected in their total revenue requirement. And the way that they designed rates is they assign this revenue requirement to various classes based on their use of the system. The judge.
Your argument that there's evidence that additional costs were incurred, or that because standby, as a general matter, will theoretically incur additional costs, it's okay.
I think the commission's point here is that because these customers are fundamentally random, because they have a right to take a full 600 megawatts of service at any time, including at peak. That they should share in some cost of the system, that will be some driver. Now, I want to point out as well.
Some driver. I mean, that's the question. So the legal, I mean, the standard here is that the commission just needs to make a theoretical, I think your argument is just a theoretical assessment of how things might work, but it's not really based in the facts of this case.
Well, I don't think that's true at all, Your Honor. I think the facts of this case, as the commission pointed out, relying primarily on Mr. Bell's testimony, is that these customers have taken service at a level greater than a straight 12 CP application would suggest. A straight 12 CP application, let's talk about the regional component, that's what the commission talked about, would assign roughly 40 megawatts of cost responsibility to these customers. But in fact, if you look at Table 3 of standby customers, witness Mr. Ross's testimony, where these demands are broken out by month. In fact, that's at J321. In fact, these customers took much more service than that, including twice during periods that were at or near the system peak. And so, the fundamental point here that PG&E made successfully to the commission is that they can't account for the nature of the standby customer's use of the system with a straight 12 CP method. It averages their total demand over the course of an entire year, and it simply doesn't pick up their actual use of the system, and the fact that because PG&E has the same obligation to serve these customers as any other customer, they have to be ready to provide the service at all times, and including at system peak. I would also point out, although this wasn't the commission's sole rationale here, the presiding judge, in her initial decision based on the testimony, made these particular findings that I'm talking about right now. There was no exception taken to those as the regulations require, and the commission explicitly affirmed them based on its review of the record. So to the extent that standby customers were objected to these findings and that there were any costs, they were obligated to raise some evidence at that time, and they did not. Standby customers, as the commission points out, they file no evidence here that would discredit anything in Mr. Bell's testimony. The commission found that Mr. Bell's testimony is simply more persuasive on this point. And under this court's standard of review, that, you know,
they won, didn't they?
They did, yes, Your Honor. And I think that's why the commission took the extra step here of also making the point that a 12 CP methodology simply wouldn't be just and reasonable because it wouldn't capture their actual use of the system. So certainly the commission, I think, recognized that in not simply relying on the fact that standby customers didn't take exception, but in addition to that, making a complete review of the record and affirming those particular judgments. I think also, just to make the point clearer here, that the commission, in its review of the evidence, clearly found that the evidence supported this particular methodology. And that was the commission's job in this case, was to determine whether the evidence supported PG&E's methodology as just and reasonable. And the 2001 data analyzed by Mr. Bell in his testimony and reviewed by the commission at paragraph 43 of its initial order really shows that. And so I want to make sure that the court understands that clearly. If there are no other questions, I will allow the court to turn to interveners. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Are these standby customers, are they mostly under PURPA?
The group represented by the petitioners here consist of some PURPA units, but many are not.
PURPA is the solution to the solution that will not die for the problem that did.
Right. Well said, Your Honor. But in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, there is some hope that at least the need to use PURPA units will decrease with centralized markets. I wanted to just perhaps amplify or perhaps clarify one point in particular. Counsel for petitioner indicated that the issue was how PG&E constructed its system over time, again focusing on the cost of building a transmission system, putting steel in the ground. PG&E's view is that is not the issue at all. The issue is how this class of customers uses the system and what benefits this class of customers derives from the use of the system. As has been conceded, I believe, in the briefs, and as is clear, contract demand is a perfectly just and reasonable basis for allocating costs. And in this case, the contract demand of this class of customers is 600 megawatts. PG&E could have, many, many years ago, proposed to allocate an amount of costs equivalent to that 600 megawatts of contract demand to this class of customers. PG&E has never done that because PG&E recognizes that all 600 megawatts that could be used isn't likely to be used. And that was the justification for a probabilistic methodology which allocates far less costs to this class than would be allocated had we gone with a straight contract demand allocation. The other point I would urge on the court is the 12CP methodology is an appropriate way to allocate costs when the parties to whom you are allocating those costs use the system at the time of system peak in essentially the same way as they use it in other times. It's a proxy for a sort of consistent use of the system. And you allocate the total system cost to the total people using it. This class of customers does not use the system consistently across all hours in the same way that they may randomly be using it at the time of system peak, which is what makes 12CP inappropriate for this.
What is the, to maintain the cost causation rate principle, what is the cost that PG&E incurs by having to stand by?
Cost could come in a number of forms, Your Honor. It could come in the form of redispatching generation if it happens that this class of customers steps up with 600 megawatts of demand at a time when there isn't 600 megawatts otherwise available. It could come in the form of interruptible customers, if need be, to accommodate these customers. It wasn't a focus. The specific costs were not a focus in the hearing below, and I agree with Mr. Dennis that petitioners did not challenge the findings of the administrative law judge as affirmed by the commission that there, in fact, were costs incurred and a benefit conferred on this class by virtue of that standing by.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Three and a half minutes. What about that? Did you is that accurate that you didn't challenge before the commission the finding of the ALJ that costs were incurred?
Yeah. What the ALJ found was that PG&E does provide a service, standing by ready to serve the standby customers, and that service does impose some costs. But that was all she found. She then went on to find that the 12CP method more accurately measured those costs. So the ALJ.
But now before us, what you're arguing, by the way, I thought your brief was very well done on a complicated problem. But I thought your argument was that there is no evidence of any costs that were incurred by PG&E for standing by. And now, but the ALJ found otherwise, and you didn't challenge that.
Well, the cost that PG&E incurs to stand by to serve our class, just like the costs it incurs to stand by to serve every other class, are the costs that are represented, at least in part, by how it builds its system. There may be other operational costs also, but the ALJ did find that the costs are incurred to stand by, but I'm arguing that those are measured by how the system is constructed.
Okay.
Mr. Patrizio, on behalf of PG&E, said that the real issue was how this class of customers uses the system. And I have to respectfully disagree. Under this court's decision in KN Energy, talking about the principle of cost causation, the test is not how the customer uses the system, but what burdens are imposed on the utility to provide that service, or as a result of how the system is used. And the evidence is that the costs that are imposed are commensurate with the impact on system peak, and that PG&E does not use this calculation of probability in reserving capacity or in any other part of its operations or its capital construction. Mr. Dennis suggested that we had not discredited Mr. Bell's testimony. He was the rate design expert witness for PG&E.
He's the one that came up with this probabilistic thing right back in 93 or something.
First did it in 93, that's correct. But I think the record is full of places in which we disagreed with Mr. Bell, and if you agree with our assessment of how the system is planned and how costs are actually incurred, we discredited his testimony. He does say in the record, he testified as to these uses that occur at other points in the year, and that they could just as likely occur on system peak. And he says, I think it's prudent for a transmission planner to take that into account. There's no evidence the transmission planner, in fact, does. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted.